whatever reason, I didn't change the title on the screen up there. We are going to be talking about what we talked about this morning. Appreciate the presence of all. Note some of our members, several of our members are out, but you're here, and I'm grateful for that. I'm here, too. I won't be for long. This is, you know, you plan a 25th anniversary trip during hurricane season, and there are certain issues that come up from time to time. It's a known risk, and you kind of take what you get. And so we're heading out in the morning, and we'll get whatever we get. It's kind of, this is the difference between mothers and fathers. This has really been impressed upon me. Tracy has spent the last, whatever, 2-3 days watching the weather reports and worrying about Taylor and saying, yeah, she's going to be here by herself. Is it going to turn into a hurricane? Is she going to be by herself? And you may all be okay. Can she put up windows? Is people going to be a helper? And I'm thinking, well, let's see, the Slinky Dog roller coaster is probably going to be closed, and the Tower of Terror is going to be open, and, you know, and different perspectives, I guess. Anyway, we're going to be, so pray for us while we're gone, if you would, please. We appreciate that very much, and thank you in advance to all the people who've offered to look after Taylor. She's going to be fine. We have every confidence of that. She's a relatively competent young woman. I think she'll be all right. Matthew chapter 24, we're going to pick up where we left off before as far as the role of Daniel and the role of Jesus in terms of prophecy, the things that they said were going to be coming. And I emphasize again, like we were talking about this morning, that just because something has particular application to a certain group of people, maybe a certain group of people 2,000 years ago, doesn't necessarily mean it has application, but the same application to us. I believe that it does have meaning for us, that it has purpose for us. It may not necessarily be the same meaning that was there for them. And when you think about that, that just kind of makes sense. There are all kinds of prophecies that we find in the Bible, and the overwhelming majority of them have already come true, except for the false ones, which didn't come true and won't come true. But the ones given by God's people were true prophecies, and they came true. Almost all of them. There are a handful that have not yet. It's been 2,000 years since these things were written that Matthew's recording for us. Here are almost 2,000 years. It's entirely possible, you got to figure, that maybe some of these things have come true already. That maybe these prophecies have already been fulfilled. And I'm going to suggest to you that most of them, if not all of them, have been fulfilled. There will be application for us as we consider these things, I believe. But the main point is that Jesus is offering direction for his contemporaries. And if you read the text in Matthew chapter 24, you're going to see that. And that there is a very specific application being made for the people of Jesus' day. Now, if you know much about Matthew chapter 24, you know that this is kind of a very popular text for people who have a premillennial viewpoint of the kingdom, people who believe that Jesus' kingdom is yet to be fulfilled on earth, at least fulfilled in its completeness, that he's going to come back to earth and reign on earth for 1,000 years as part of end time events. And generally speaking, it's in recent past been universally the case, maybe not quite so much these days, but in the last 30 years or so, end time events means right around the corner. And right around the corner has come and gone and turned to other corners and other corners after that. We still haven't gotten to end time events, so that's going to get frustrating, I think, for premillennialists, and I'm not going to get too far down that rabbit hole. I will say this, that people continue to go to Matthew chapter 24 looking for some kind of direction for how the world is going to end, how all these things are going to be brought to accumulation. And there are some principles that we're going to talk about here that maybe have application to those kind of things. But as far as the direction that Jesus is giving, the pointers, the information that's being handed out, I think we're going to see very clearly that his message is very different from that. He's talking about an end time, very different than what you and I typically think of when we're told about end time events, or we read in the newspaper or the magazines or whatever about end time events. But you'll notice that, and the parallel between Jesus and Daniel, again, we're going to try to emphasize this, that Jesus' prophecy is very much like Daniel's prophecy. They share a lot of the same kind of language and the same kind of structure and the same overall message.
the message of doom and despair and destruction, which will be followed by hope. That this is a testing ground. This is an opportunity for failure or an opportunity for success, depending on who you are, depending on how you respond to the message that God is trying to give through these difficult times. Back in Daniel's day, it was the Babylonians and the Persians. And here in Jesus' day, it's the Romans. And his message is, yes, in fact, things are pretty bad. You know what? They're going to get worse. In fact, they're going to get a lot worse. Within your lifetime, they're going to get worse. And what you need to do is not hope against hope that somehow it's not going to be happening. What you need to do is be prepared. And be found faithful in that day. And if you are trusting in God, if you're trusting in this message, and if you remember what Jesus has said in these situations, he says, then you may be able to survive this. And you may be able to prosper and, in fact, come out the other end stronger than you were before. That is going to be Jesus' main prophecy. Now, I'm aware that terms like the end of the age, for instance, verse number 3 of Matthew chapter 24, the disciples ask, tell us, when will these things happen? And what will be the sign of your coming in the end of the age? Now, my entire life, as I've read Matthew chapter 24 presented and preached on, I have heard that, and this is the typical premillennial point, the typical premillennial message. And to a certain degree, my brethren have glommed onto this. But this is two different questions. Jesus, the disciples ask about these things, the throwing down the temple stones, which is pretty obvious, and the end of the age. And then Jesus goes on to preach about the throwing down the temple stones and about the end of the age. I'm going to suggest to you here, and I want you to go back and check me out on this, and read the alternate accounts in Mark and Luke, especially Luke, by the way, for this. I think that you will find that there's a compelling case to be made that end of the age in this context is talking about end of the Jewish age. It's not talking about the end of time. It's not talking about what we would call the end of the age, that is to say the end of our age. He's talking about the end of the Jewish age, which comes to a climax, as it were, when the city of Jerusalem is destroyed in the early 70s A.D. Now, I say that you ought to read Matthew and Luke, or Mark and Luke, and especially Luke, because Matthew 24 is always the passage that people go to. And I think this is why. I haven't interviewed a lot of premillennialists on this subject, so I couldn't speak with authority on this. But I bet you this is it. That the way Matthew's question is phrased here, the way the disciples' question is phrased in Matthew, lends itself to this interpretation. If you read Luke's account doesn't read like this. Now, what Jesus says in response to the question is almost exactly the same. And you're aware of the concept of parallel accounts and the synoptic gospels and such. Matthew, Mark, and Luke all tell this story. And as far as I can tell, you can pretty much agree that these are all the same account. They're all the same disciples asking the same basic questions, and Jesus giving the same basic answers. And if you've never read anything except for Luke's account, you wouldn't be thinking about the end of the age. You'd be thinking about the end of Jerusalem. And I suggest to you, it's just a different way of phrasing the very same thing. The disciples are asking the same questions. It's the same event, after all. And what we read in Matthew chapter 24 is simply a description of how all of this that he's just been talking about is going to come about. And when you think about it, it seems kind of strange, doesn't it? Jesus says, not one stone's going to be left on another. Wow, the temple's going to be destroyed. We've been working on this thing for decades, and it's not finished yet. Supposedly, it had been construction on the temple had been finished for about 6 years when it finally got. It was 100 years or so in the reconstruction, and it was finished for about 6 years, and then the Romans tore it down. So that's the way it works, I guess, sometimes. And the disciples hear him saying that these stones are going to be torn down, and they say, will you please tell us about how the temple is going to be destroyed? Oh, and hey, while you're at it, tell us about the end of the world. You know, where does that come from? What kind of a conversation is that? I suggest to you that's not what the disciples asked. They're simply asking about the end of these things. Luke chapter 21, you'll notice I alluded to this, and I'll flip over there and read very quickly. In Luke 21 and verse number 7, the same question is posed, but it sounds a little different.
They questioned him, saying, "Teacher, when therefore will these things happen?" That is the throwing down of the stones. "And what will be the sign when these things are about to take place?" And that's the end of it. Again, he's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem in Luke. And he says the same thing in Luke that he says in Matthew. So again, I suggest you saying the same thing about the destruction of Jerusalem in Matthew. Anyway, go back and study that some more and let me know what you think about this. What Jesus is saying in Matthew chapter 24 is that there is destruction coming, and there are going to be specific signs that attach themselves to that. People are supposed to be looking for things. And we read over much of this text earlier, but I'll refer you piecemeal to some of this, and I would urge you to read this in some more detail later on. Skip down to verse number 32, for instance. "Now learn the parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. So you too, when you see all these things," and he's been talking about the abomination of desolation and similar things. "When you see these things," he says, "recognize that he is near, right at the door. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away." And that's a figure of speech there. He gives us in verse number 35, that no matter what you think may be permanent, this is more permanent than that. What's permanent is my word. This is going to happen, he says. And it's going to happen in this generation. Now, the premillennialists will have you say that we've changed subjects at this point. That now we're talking about end time events, which is kind of odd when you think about it. Because if this is end time events, why does he tell us that there's these specifics? It's like looking for a fig tree when there's going to be fruit. You see the fig tree blooming properly with the leaves out. That's when there's going to be fruit there. That's a specific sign. And that's when you go and look at the fig tree and look for figs. Now, what does Jesus have to say? What do his disciples have to say about the end of time and specific events, specific signs, things like that? Is there going to be some kind of, you know, riding the sky, you know, end time event starting 12 o'clock today here? You know, no. The Lord's going to come as a thief, right? That's what Paul says. That's what Peter says. It's going to be an undisclosed kind of thing. It's going to be a sudden kind of thing, unannounced, unexpected. Well, these events here are going to come with advertising. Jesus is going to tell you very specifically in some situations what it's going to look like. And he says it's going to happen within the lifetime of this generation. Now, traditionally, in Jewish literature, a generation is 40 years. Jesus is generally thought to be speaking here and eventually dying in what we would call the year AD 30. If you add 30 and 40, what do you get? You get 70. So God gave him a full generation. He gave him 40 whole years. But after that generation is over, Jesus said it was not going to pass away. Well, here we are at the end of the generation, and sure enough, things pass away. So there's plenty of internal evidence to support this notion that it's talking about the end of Jerusalem. It's talking about the end of the Jews, not talking about the end of the entire world. Notice this also, that there are things that you can do to avoid this destruction. Now again, back up for a second. We're talking about end time events here for a second. What do you think you might be able to do to avoid Jesus' return? What might you be able to do to get out of the path of all this chaos and destruction that is going to be wreaked upon the sinful world upon his return? I saw a couple of heads just kind of doing that. Well, that's right. That's what the Bible teaches, right? Nothing. Look at what Jesus says about these times. In verse number 17, whoever is on the housetop must not go down to get the things that are in his house. Whoever is in the field must not turn around to get his cloak. But woe to those who are pregnant and those who are nursing babies in those days. But pray that your flight will not be in a winter, nor on the Sabbath. Now, exactly what does any of that have to do with the end of the world? It'd sure be nice if when the Lord comes the second time that you're not pregnant. Or wouldn't it be a bummer if he came in the winter? Wouldn't that be a problem? None of that has anything to do with Jesus' return. Clearly, this is talking about a historical event that came with some degree of warning, that a little bit of foresight, a little bit of preparedness, preparation, and quick action could make all the difference in the world. Kind of like the biggest army in the world coming down the road to destroy everything you've ever seen or known. That would fit very well with this. Again, I suggest you that's exactly the kind of signs that Jesus is saying you need to be aware of. And aware Realize also that this is something that's written before these events and something that you can anticipate, including this so-called abomination of desolation. Jesus refers to the language that we saw in Daniel earlier this morning. He says in verse number 15 and 16, "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place," and then if you have your red letter versions here, you may have a break in the red letters, and a little parenthetical expression that says, "Let the reader understand." And then he picks up again. "Then let those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains," etc. So there's coming an event here when you see the abomination of desolation, and Jesus, or either Jesus or Matthew, depending on the way you look at it, says here, "Let the reader understand." What does he mean by that? He means that if you are reading Matthew in the 50s, 60s, A.D., and you're aware of, at least in general terms, that Jesus said that destruction was coming upon the Jews, and you happen to be living in Judea at this time, maybe you ought to be paying attention. Maybe you ought to be watching the news, you know, watching the horizon, see if the Romans are coming. And then when you actually see the abomination of desolation, he says, "Let the reader understand. This is what Jesus was talking about here." Well, what in the world is an abomination of desolation? There are some speculations of what that looks like, but I think that we can at least take this away for sure. If the average Jew sitting in the temple saw the abomination of desolation and he had any notion of what Daniel had written 600 years before, he would know exactly what he was looking at. This is a bold type red letter sign that with a gigantic circle around it. It's the way it's portrayed in Daniel. It's the way that Jesus portrays it here. You will know what you're looking for if you're looking for it. And when you do, get out of town as quickly as you possibly can. He says, don't turn around to get your coat. Don't pack a bag. Don't do anything. Move as fast as you can. And that's why you hope that you're not pregnant at that time, because you'll move faster if you're not pregnant. So this is something that Matthew's readers, and Matthew's writing primarily to a Jewish audience here, it might be worth noting here. Matthew's readers would be able to identify this abomination when it came up. And when it did come up, this complete destruction that Daniel talked about in his context is also going to be seen in Matthew's context, in Jesus' context. Look at what verse 24 reads. Chapter 24, rather, and verse number 21. "For then there will be a great tribulation, such as has not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever will. Unless those days have been cut short, no life would have been saved. For the sake of the elect, these days will be cut short. Then if anyone says to you, 'Behold, here is the Christ,' or 'There he is,' do not believe him. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and will show great signs and wonders so as to mislead, if possible, even the elect. Behold, I have told you in advance," going all the way through verse number 25 now. Notice what Jesus is saying here. He says that there's going to be a great tribulation. And of course, this phrase has been grabbed by the premillennialists, and they'll make great hay with this idea of the great tribulation. They're not quite sure what to do with the great tribulation. Exactly how you align all these end time events is a little difficult. And depending on which book you're reading, they may line them up a little bit differently. They all disagree. Exactly. But they all agree there's going to be a great tribulation. And that's what Jesus is talking about here. Well, he is talking about a great tribulation, but in the context of the destruction of Jerusalem. If you're, again, a Jew in the first century and the Romans are coming to destroy everything you've ever heard of, that perfectly fits in with the context that Jesus is giving here in Matthew chapter 24, as well as the biblical context of this idea of great tribulation. Tribulation like nobody has ever seen before. This is the kind of language that always attaches itself to this kind of event. And Jesus is using that language that Matthew's readers are well acquainted with, that hopefully we're well acquainted with, to help them understand how bad this event is going to be. And here's the hope at the end of this. A lot of doom and gloom, a lot of destruction is going to happen here. And no doubt some good people are going to be caught up in this. But there is going to be life at the end of it. Notice after the tribulation, the sun will be darkened, etc. All this apocalyptic language borrowing from Joel and other places in verse number 29. And these signs are going to be given. And then the Son of Man comes on the clouds with power and great glory, verse number 29. Well, again, surely that's talking about the end of the world. Go back a little bit. Remember from this morning what we're talking about from Daniel. In Daniel chapter 12, verse 4. And by the way, I got a lot of very positive feedback from the lesson this morning. I appreciate that very much. I hope that you're not done studying this. I hope that you agree with me. I hope I'm right. I hope we're right on this. Because I always like to be right instead of being wrong. Right's always better than wrong. But if we are correct that this apocalyptic language given to us in Daniel chapter 12 is not in fact talking about the end of time, but it's talking about the end of Jewish time, the end of the Jewish age, well, why not the same thing here? Could not the same language be used by Jesus to describe events within time? Events that are cataclysmic to a certain group of people, but not necessarily everybody. Again, know who the audience of the prophecy is. This audience is a Jewish audience. Now, a lot of people, including a lot of my preaching brethren, are going to disagree with me on that, and that's okay. You know, we can maybe agree to disagree on this. There are some principles I think that we're going to get to in the next slide before we close up that we'll be able to agree on here. But at least consider the possibility that what Jesus is saying here is that destruction is coming upon the Jews like you will never see again, that you have never seen before. Absolute disaster. And consider also that everything before this and everything after this is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. Maybe this is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem also. Now, that being the case, he will send forth his angels, he says, with a great trumpet, and will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other. Now, again, that sounds like what you might call the rapture, or the second coming, or whatever you want to call it. But I would suggest to you that it's actually saying that in this time of terror, in this time of horror, when people are dying left and right, there are going to be some people who actually remembered what Jesus said from their life with Jesus. Or they read what Matthew wrote about Jesus after the fact. And living in that area, they saw these signs, and they were in fact able to escape destruction. And the elect, and after all, who's going to be reading and listening to Jesus' words more carefully than Christians, right? It's entirely possible that God's people knew what was coming. They believed Jesus' words of prophecy. They responded to them properly. And because of that, they were not caught up in all of this death and destruction like everybody else was. In any case, regardless of how you feel about this particular passage with regard to Christians and salvation in AD 70, there is at least this application. A spiritual application, more than a physical one. And if you disagree with me on the other, that's fine. But let's agree on this. That over and over again in the epistles, true Israel, the true circumcision, language like this is used to describe the people of God. And the people of God in times past were descended from Abraham. They accepted Abraham's faith. They lived Abraham's kind of lifestyle. And God proved to them in that situation. But the spiritual legacy of Abraham is not in the flesh. It's not in his blood. It's not in his genes. It's in his faith. And when we come to God in trusting and obedient faith through Jesus Christ, we are the true heirs of Abraham. We are the true elect. And there are many, many passages in the Bible that refer to this. I'm going to point you toward a couple of them, and I would encourage you again to do some more research on your own. And in Philippians chapter 3 and verse number 3, Paul addresses this. He has rather harsh words to say about those of his physical brethren, his fellow Jews, including Jewish Christians, who were dismissing the notion of the Gentiles and saying the Gentiles had to become Jews in the flesh to be saved, as it were. Paul denies this. He's always denied this. He says, beware, verse number 2, beware of the dogs, beware of the evil workers, beware of the false circumcision. For we are the true circumcision, who worship in the Spirit of God and glory in Christ Jesus and put no confidence in the flesh. And he goes on to talk about his own flesh, his own heritage in Jesus, his own heritage in Israel, his own heritage in Abraham, which is considerable and noteworthy by Jewish standards. He says, that's not where we put our confidence anymore. That's not where I put my confidence anymore. The true circumcision, the true Israel, are the ones who live their lives in faith. And in this gospel era, that means living their lives in faith in Jesus Christ. Galatians chapter 3, I'll give you one more example, then we'll move on. Galatians 3 and verse number 6 and 7. Even so, Abraham believed God and was reckoned to him as righteousness. Therefore, be sure that it is those who are of faith who are the sons of Abraham. That's us, right? People who have faith in God, and because of their faith in God, have faith in Jesus. We are the spiritual Israel today. And backing up to Matthew chapter 24, what it's saying is at least this, if nothing else, at least it's saying this, that in this chaos, in this destruction, in this demonstration of God's wrath against a nation that one generation after another persecuted righteousness, persecuted the prophets, turned their back on God. You've read the Old Testament, you know what I'm talking about. Ultimately, God's patience with them was exhausted, and he came in wrath against them in the first century. But those who had faith, the faith of Abraham, the faith of David, the faith of Moses, the faith of Isaiah, the faith of Jeremiah, the faith of the apostles, in the gospel era, those who came to Jesus in trusting and obedient faith, these ones were able to escape. These, and not just escape physically, although they very, very well may have. Most Christians weren't in Jerusalem when this happened. We're not in Jerusalem. I've never been to Jerusalem personally. He's saying there that you are going to emerge from this chaos. You're going to emerge from this trial. And you're going to be stronger than you were before. There are plenty of people who are going to completely abandon God if they survive at all. But you won't. You will see this as God's righteous wrath against a wayward people, and you'll be driven that much further into his arms. True Israel is going to survive and thrive because of this. It will not be destroyed, no matter how many stones in the temple are knocked over. Now, I would urge you to read that and consider that more on your own time. We're going to move on at this point, and one of these days maybe I'll come back and talk a little bit more about Matthew chapter 24. But let's talk about some takeaways here before we close up. What does this mean for me? If Matthew 24 is just talking about the Jews, and it's just talking about the first century, why are we reading Matthew chapter 24? What does this have to do with me? Why is it recorded for us? Why is it preserved for us? I'll offer you a few things here. First of all, realize that God's warnings need to be heeded. In general, if God gives you a warning, whether it's the destruction of your nation, your own personal salvation, whatever it happens to be, including the end of the world, including ultimate judgment, when God gives you a warning, the reason for that warning is so that you can listen to it. Now, we live in a weird era these days when we get warnings all the time about silly, ridiculous things, right? You can't buy a ladder without a warning sticker on it, you know? If you go buy a lawnmower and there's a sticker on there that says warning not to be used as hedge clippers. Well, thanks for that. You know, I'm not sure that warning is enhancing my life any. That's not what I buy lawnmowers for, right? My lawnmower, of course, is a human pellet that wouldn't serve as a hedge clipper anyway. So I don't have a sticker on mine. Anyway. That God gives warnings for a reason. They're not pointless. They're not redundant. They're not ridiculous at all. They're real. And we need to pay attention to them, including the warnings that are given to us in Matthew chapter 24. Now, if they have specific application for the people in that day, for that destruction they were about to see, surely it talks about principles that apply to all of God's judgments, including final judgment. And we have emphasized in our own minds as we read these things that God has expectations of me too. And God has requirements of me. And if I do not listen to his warnings, things will go very poorly for me. I need to pay attention. Matthew chapter 24 and verse 42, for instance, There are several parables, little stories that Jesus gives in this context that basically make the same point. Be ready. Be prepared. Be prepared at all times, he says. Therefore, be on the alert, for you do not know which day your Lord is coming. But be sure of this. If the head of the house had known what time the thief was coming, he would not have been on the alert and would not have allowed his house to be broken into. For this reason, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not think he will. Now, again, I don't think that has specific application to the destruction of all things, to the end of time, as we would call it, the Lord's return. But certainly it has general application to that. In fact, the language is quite similar to what we see in 1 Thessalonians and in 2 Peter as far as the Lord coming as a thief. Well, here Jesus uses that very same thief analogy. When are you going to be ready for the thief? You going to be ready for the thief when he tells you he might be coming? You know, Tuesdays, I'm looking Tuesdays, coming and breaking your house, steal your television set. Well, I'll be ready on Tuesday then. But that's not the way that it works, right? The thief comes when you're not expecting, and so therefore you have to be ready all the time. You always lock your doors. You always, you know, pay the insurance premiums and all of that sort of thing. That's what we're supposed to do as wise, reasonable stewards of God's things. And if it had application to the Jews back in that time, surely it has at least as much application to us today as we look forward to ultimately giving account to the Lord for the things that we've done in this life. Secondly, God's people are to be tested. There are going to be rough times. I don't know exactly how bad it's going to get. I don't know if it's going to get as bad as it did for Jewish Christians in the first century. I don't suppose it really matters a whole lot. The important thing is this. Regardless of where you live or when you live, all those who live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. There are hardships that are hardwired into this physical existence that you cannot escape no matter how hard you try. And that's okay. Not a good thing necessarily, but it can be a profitable thing if you will allow the circumstances, and especially the negative circumstances of this life, to drive you closer to God, to get you to focus more on your spiritual responsibility, your heavenly home, your hope of escape after this life is over. If the hardships of this life drive you in a spiritual direction, in a Godward direction, then we can profit in the long term because of our faith. And we may or may not escape the hardships that come in this life. But ultimately, we will be emboldened in the life that we're living, the life of faith and the life of hope that we're living. Peter talks about this in his first letter, 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 17 and following. He talks about judgment. And again, we're not talking about final judgment here, I don't think. I think we're still talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. And Peter's writing to a Jewish audience, I believe, in 1 Peter. He says, "For now it's time for judgment to begin with the household of God. And if it begins with us first, what will be the outcome for those who do not obey the gospel of God? And if it is with difficulty that the righteous is saved, what will become of the godless man and the sinner? Therefore, those also who suffer according to the will of God shall entrust their souls to a faithful Creator in doing what is right." What he's saying here is that life is hard, and it's going to be hard for you as a Christian. And if you think that's fair or unfair, then think about how bad it's going to be for people who aren't Christians. If God is willing for His people to go through this, imagine how hard it must be for those who are not His people. It's with tremendous difficulty that you're going to get through this life. He's not talking about crawling on your hands and knees toward the finish line, just barely squeezing across as time expired and you just qualify for heaven by a tenth of a second. That's not the kind of with difficulty we're talking about here. He's saying your life is going to be hard. Young people, if you haven't heard this yet, I apologize for spoiling the ending for you. Life is going to come with a lot of hardships. You think you understand when you're 18 years old. You do not. Okay? Your parents will tell you about it. Your grandparents will tell you about it. And being a Christian is not going to fix that. Being a Christian is not going to save that. In fact, in some ways, it's going to hurt. He says in this very passage here, many, you're going to suffer because you're a Christian, let alone despite being a Christian. That's what this life is. And when we accept this, and we accept our role in life, when we accept the role of tribulation that comes in this life, then we can use the hardships as well as the blessings to focus us more and more on becoming the kind of people that God is trying to get us to be. Now, if you, Job, one of Job's friends uses the analogy, "Man is born for trouble, sparks fly upward," in Job 5, verse 7. That's one of my favorite images in the book of Job, because oftentimes I feel like a piece of steel that's been, you know, and steel's pretty hard, right? You figure steel's going to be tough, and it goes in the fire and burns for a couple hours, and that, you know, doesn't feel very good. I've never been a bar of steel, but I can't believe that's a really positive kind of thing. And then finally the steel gets taken out of the fire. Oh, good news. And then what happens? What's the blacksmith starts doing? Starts beating on it with a hammer, right? Well, I thought, you know, thought things are getting better. Now things are getting worse, in fact. But at the end of it, this piece of steel that the blacksmith has been working on is much, much stronger than it would have been apart from all this horrible, horrible activity. And that's what life does for us. Life hardens us. It strengthens us. It empowers us to be able to do things for the Lord that we would not have been able to do otherwise. A sword that ordinarily would break will not break now, because it's been toughened and tempered by the Lord. Thirdly, and I think we'll close with this, God's reward is to be anticipated. And this, more than anything else, this gets us through this. It's all fine and good for the preacher to say, you're becoming a better Christian because of all this. You really ought to be grateful for all of your hardships, because you're a better person now, and you're stronger in your faith. And don't you feel good after having suffered like this? And you're saying, no, not really. I feel like I suffered. And it feels like pain. It feels a lot like pain, in fact. In fact, I would call it pain. That's what it is. It's not growth. It's not development. It's pain. And I get it. I've been there too. And if strengthening your character and growing in your faith and growing your determination toward God, if that doesn't do it for you, then think about that. And surely that will do it for you. Because that's what this is all about, right? God promises not just that you're going to become His kind of person in this life. He promises that you're becoming the kind of person that God is going to save in heaven for all of eternity. Now that is motivation, even more than the other. And that reward is to absolutely be on the tip of our nose at all times. We're always thinking about this, about becoming God's kind of person, not just because we want to, not just because it pleases God, although that ought to be enough motivation, but because we demonstrate ourselves to be the kind of people who are going to inherit this tremendous reward, this wonderful blessing of heaven that the Scriptures try to tell us about. It gives us grand glowing images, and I have every confidence that it's far, far greater than can be contained in paper and pen. But what we need to do is make sure that we anticipate, that we are ready at all times. And again, I would urge you to go back and read those stories that Jesus tells in Matthew 24 and 25 about preparedness, the 10 virgins, and the story of the judgment scene that he gives there in the five-talent man, three-talent man, or two-talent man, the one-talent man, being ready, being prepared, doing what it takes to be God's kind of person when you absolutely have to be God's kind of person. But I'll leave you with a story from real life instead of a story that Jesus told. The night that Jesus was betrayed, Jesus goes into the Garden of Gethsemane, and he takes his disciples with him, and then he takes his three closest disciples a little bit further with him. And he asks them to do one thing. And I have my theories on why he asks this, but suffice it to say for our purposes, he asks. He asks them to stay awake. Now, I've fallen asleep when I wanted to stay awake before. I'm sure you have too. I would like to think that if the person who was nearest and dearest to me wanted me more than anything to stay awake for another hour and a half, that I'd be able to do that, even without a smartphone to play with or whatever. The disciples were not able to do that. The disciples, Peter, James, and John, they fell asleep. And Jesus tells them in verse number 41 of Matthew chapter 26. He says, "Keep watching and praying that you will not enter into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." That may seem on the surface to be rather harsh. They fell asleep. They were tired. It's the middle of the night. They've been walking. They're worn out. Why wouldn't they fall asleep? They shouldn't have fallen asleep because the Lord asked them not to fall asleep. And this failure on their part, in what might seem on the surface to be an inconsequential thing, is in fact a commentary on their commitment to the Lord. Jesus says in Luke chapter 16, "The one who's faithful in a little thing is going to be faithful also in much." And this failure in attitude, this failure in commitment that Peter, James, and John show is amplified shortly thereafter when Jesus is caught and arrested and taken prisoner, and they all flee. They're not ready. Now, they are able to grow from this experience. They're able to develop. They're able to be an answer to Jesus' prayer here. But wouldn't it be great if when the moment came for you and me, death or some trial before between now and then, when the hour came when we really needed to be faithful, when we really needed to be prepared, that we were found prepared in that day. Wouldn't that be great if we knew exactly what to do, if we knew exactly what to say, if we were able to withstand temptation instead of giving in to it and making excuses for ourselves? Wouldn't that be wonderful if we were in fact ready, if the flesh was strong while the spirit was willing? That's the question. And as we make one good decision and one bad decision after another, we determine for ourselves what kind of direction we're going to go in. And all of this points toward eternity. All of it points toward end time events. And again, if Matthew 24 is not specifically talking about such things, it certainly has application to end time events. Because there is coming a time when you and I are going to be held accountable for everything that we've done, for the life that we live, the life that we lived in faith or did not live in faith. And if we were able to stand in judgment in that day and give account and say, Lord, I wasn't perfect, and I'm certainly leaning on your mercy, but I want you to know, I gave my life to you, and I did what I could do, and I tried to live in faith, and if you would please have mercy on me in these moments. We have confidence that the true child of faith, the true child of Abraham, is going to be saved in that day. Not because he did such a great job, not because she did such a great job, but because we serve a merciful God who has promised that if you will live your life in faith, if you will commit yourself to him in this life, that he will save you, that he will deliver you and take you home to be with him in heaven after this life is over. That is his assurance, not my assurance, not the elder's assurance. That's God's assurance. And you can take him at his word. So we urge you, as we offer the invitation here this evening, to make your life right with God, to put him first in your life, to deny the flesh, to focus on spiritual things, to focus on your heavenly home, to realize that you are going to be held accountable for the things that you do at some point. And if you have not been baptized in water for remission of sins, if you have never given yourself over to Jesus Christ, realize the predicament that you're in. Realize that you have not yet put yourself on this path that leads to glory. You're not going to get to the glory unless you're on the path to glory. So why don't you make that right this very evening? Why don't you put Jesus on in baptism? Why don't you live the rest of your life in faith and trust and hope and the occasional failure, but trusting in him to save you, and then go to heaven when you die? If there's anything we can do to help you along this path, please allow us to do so while we stand and sing.